All right, reel six. So you didn't see very much of the countryside. Did you get around the towns very much, next to the cantonments?
No, very seldom. You see, well, one went shopping occasionally for into a bookshop. There was one very good bookshop in Rawalpindi, and he had a branch up in the Murray Hills, and they had every possible English publication you could think of there, and they were extremely good. That's the only sort of a shop that I went to. My wife, of course, went to the fashion shops, such as there were. I've forgotten whether hair was done in those days or not, or whether that was invented later. Ladies' hair, I mean. But if so, she would have gone there too. No, we didn't go into the towns much. We stayed in our own cantonments. Abbottabad was rather smaller, and in order to get any exercise at all, you had to walk round the town. It was a very much smaller place. Only about, 50 or 60 other bungalows there, without counting the barracks, of which there were a great many. There was a sports field in the middle of the town where the Gurkhas in particular would be playing hockey or some of the other games. But there were very few shops that I can think of. In fact, the only one that I can think of was the dentist. I went in there once with a frightful ache, and a young man came out and examined me and said, "Sir, you will have to have every tooth out." And then came his boss, and he came and looked at me too, and he said, "I think I'll have to take out one tooth."
So you just had the one out?
So we had the one out, and that was that. Since then, we've had the lot out.
When you were going around the towns on the occasions that you did go, did you ever feel uneasy? Or did you ever feel uneasy at any time in India moving about?
Never. No, never. The Indians that we met all had a great respect for us. They would move off the pavement if there were a footwalk and let you pass them. Oh no, I never once felt in any way nervous with any Indians. Never. As I say, they had a great respect for us. They are a very well-mannered people on the whole, no question about that. Probably the best-mannered people in the world. They'd never dream of doing anything that would seem to be an insult, either by gesture or by voice. I give them the fullest credit for that.
Was any hostility ever shown to you?
Never.
From Indians?
No, never. I never saw any sign of hostility of any kind. I think the Indians then were thoroughly reconciled. Certainly those in the cantonments were accustomed to British people, thoroughly reconciled to the fact that the British were not a bad lot. And that although we were, if you like, an army of occupation, we were by no means high-booted, jack-stepping sort of crowd like that, but perfectly prepared to make friends with them and eat and drink with them if we could. The difficulties of caste rather inhibited against that kind of thing. And therefore, there's extremely little mixture between Indian and British. Of course, you had your half-Indians. I only met one man. He was a barrister who had married an Indian, and therefore had a half-caste family. And he was one who'd, well, as we say, gone back to the country. But he was perhaps shunned by other white people. It was rather a pity. He was rather an amusing man. I remember a court-martial that he and I were both on. I was prosecuting the quartermaster sergeant, and he was defending him, a charge of falsifying the regimental pay accounts. And at one time he said, "I object," something that I'd been saying. And the president of the court immediately said, "Right, court is closed, you gentlemen will withdraw." So we both withdrew, and the prisoner was kicked out, and the court apparently sat down to settle this point of view, the objection. And I said to this barrister, "What was your objection? Tell me." "Oh," he said, "I wanted a cigarette, don't you?" And I said, that was the only objection that I could find out that he got. He was just making an objection, hoping that he wouldn't be asked what it was, and he wasn't. And we went back into the court, and the president merely said, "I overruled the objection." My opponent merely sat down, that was that. I said, he was a man with a sense of humor, and like a great many lawyers, was really very well educated, and I could have talked with him for hours. I never saw him again.
Which station?
But he was, practically speaking, the only white civilian whom I met, the only English civilian whom I met in the country.
Which station did you prefer in India, if any?
Well, I liked Abbottabad because it was such a small place. It was cool. It had a good growth of trees all around it. The scenery was just too lovely for words. And everybody there was so friendly. Rawalpindi was much too big. And, Abbottabad was entirely a Gurkha town, and I got to like the Gurkhas very much indeed.
Why did you like them so much?
It's very hard to say. They're such a cheerful lot of soldiers. Always a smile and a grin never very far away. And always a tremendous respect that they had for the British officer. And, for that matter, the British soldier.
Was there any station which you didn't like very much, apart from Rawalpindi?
Well, I only had these two stations, Rawalpindi and Abbottabad. I did go to Ambala, as I said, once on holiday. And I quite liked Ambala too. I had a very busy little time there. My host lent me his horse, and I was able to ride around and see the country quite a lot. And there we had not interregimental, but sports ones between this regiment, the East Lancashires, and the athletes of the local Maharaja, in which the Maharaja's men were a very athletic lot indeed. They're all huge chaps, over 6 feet. They rather dwarfed East Lancashires, and they won the majority of the events.
Can you tell me if the officers in the army in India preferred any particular province in India to another? Did they show any preference or not?
I never knew of any, no. No, I never knew of any. But if you were in India long enough, you would have changed about from province to province and should get that experience. I remember our 2nd Battalion, when I joined the regiment, was just outside Calcutta in Dum Dum. Later they moved to Agra. And they seemed to like both stations. When I was with the 1st Battalion, as I say, we were in Rawalpindi to start with, and then actually in my last year they moved up to up the Khyber Pass and remained in garrison there. Now there, of course, there was no society except that of the other regiments who were in the Khyber with us. Women were not allowed to travel up the Khyber. If they did travel up the Khyber, they went back again same day. One or two of the officers' wives did come up like that, but they were never allowed to stay the night. They had to go back again to Peshawar, at least, during the same evening.
Were you ever nervous for your own family in India?
No, I never felt any anxiety for them. Never.
What about the attitude of the officers towards the Indian population? Or sections of the Indian population, did they distinguish between different groups, either on a provincial basis, like Punjabis and Bengalis and Madrasis, on a religious basis, like Hindus and Muslims? I mean, did they have preferences for one section to another or not?
I don't think so. No, I think they either liked the local people or disliked them, or far more likely paid no attention to them, just regarded them as a necessary part of the country, like the vegetation and so forth. But I don't think they worried much about religion or race or any other difference there might be. They would, of course, appreciate the difference between, let's say, the gentlemen in India, the princes and so forth, and the tradesmen, but so would everybody else. Even in this country, we don't necessarily dash about and make friends with our grocer, do we? And the same applies abroad. In fact, more so there, because I suppose the British people had the feeling that they must keep up the prestige and so forth of Englishmen in a foreign country. And you couldn't get away from it. We British are far too snobbish in our regard. And it is that that probably went a long way towards hastening the shout for independence in India. But I doubt if many people in India have really gained by their independence. Only the politicians, the shouters after fame. But I think the majority, the vast majority of the people there, especially the farmers, the crofters, the lower class people like that, must have lost all feeling of security. You'll remember that immediately after independence had been declared, the Pakistanis and the Indians murdered each other right, left and center, till there must have been millions on both sides slaughtered in that stupid business. Now, what could have been the feeling of those unfortunate people who were caught up between these bands of lawbreakers, and their feeling of the security they'd had while the British army was there? They must have lost all sense of feeling, and very, very few, except the orators, the praetors, can have gained anything at all by independence. Of course, that applies not only to India, but to all the states of Africa which are now independent. Even America, which became independent many years before us, started off by murdering the Indians and clearing them out. And look what happens now in Ireland since the Irish got their independence. What's going to happen if the Welsh and the Scots get independence? Well, I've always said England for the English.
So you thought the British rule was a good thing for India then?
Oh, it undoubtedly was. In just the same way as in the whole way through Africa, we brought them up from savagery in some places to civilization in others. Well, there we were. The Indians are, of course, far more civil, always were far more civilized than the Africans. And therefore, I presume, that is why they got their civilization first. But whether they've gained or not, it is not for me to say, but my own opinion is that they have not.
But what about the conditions of poverty of so many Indians? Did you think that this was Britain's responsibility, or what did you think was the what did you and the other officers at the time think was the reason for the poverty of so many sections of the Indian people? If you thought about it at all, that is.
I don't think we talked about it at all, no. We knew that there was a great deal of poverty in the country. But then we knew there was a great deal of poverty at home here. There was very little that we could do about it, and quite beyond us to cope with it in India. All that we were there for in India was to see that the Hindus didn't murder them, the Mohammedans, and on the other side, that the Muslims didn't murder the Hindus. Try and keep the peace between all sections of the community. And that I think we did.
What was the attitude of you and the other officers at the time in India, if you had any attitude at all, that is, towards those politicians, Indian politicians, who were agitating for independence?
Well, in my day, Gandhi was, of course, very much on the stage. And I think we all thought, well, what a darn nuisance that man is. And we hoped he wouldn't come and stir up things in our area. And he didn't. So we were quite happy on that. With regard to all the other agitators, I think we regarded them in much the same way. We just hoped they wouldn't come our way. We didn't think that they had all the influence that they later showed they had got. And we just hoped and hoped that nothing wrong would happen.
What did you think to Gandhi at the time? Did you think he was a crank, or did you respect him?
Oh, yes, we regarded him as a crank.
And what did you think to Indian political parties, if you thought anything at all, like Congress, the Congress Party, or the Muslim League?
Well, yes, there were those two parties, of course. There may have been more, but I never heard of any more. They've developed, I think, since. Well, we didn't think, if we gave the matter much thought, that either the Muslim League or the Hindu Congress would get very far. We didn't think in terms of independence. That didn't come until after the war, as you know. But, of course, it was obviously building up in those days. But it was still in the early stage, and it didn't affect us.
Did you ever see any evidence of political activity by Indians?
No, never.
Any demonstrations?
No, never. You see, we were in garrison town. There were always the troops there. Now, if we'd been in towns without a garrison, and these agitations had gone up, we'd have certainly... that's rather a different matter. We'd have seen them and had to take steps about them, if the police called for our help.
Did you think that independence would eventually come to India whilst you were an officer in India?
No, I can't say I did, no.
What about the other officers? Do you think that they thought the same as you?
I should think so. Yes, I should think so.
Did you ever discuss politics with each other in the messes?
No. No. Oh, no. Politics, like women, are two things which are not discussed in an officer's mess.
What about newspapers? What newspapers did you have?
We had the Statesman of India, which was the only... well, it was one of the very few papers printed in English.
No English newspapers?
Oh, yes, we got the English newspapers in time, but of course it took them... I'm not certain that they had those airmail editions, which are now quite common, printed on that very fine paper, which makes them so light. I don't think so. We used to get our Timeses, and I suppose our telegraphs, about 3 weeks late, arriving by ship.
Did you have access to radio?
Yes, we had radio, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. It was over there that we learnt of the death of the king in 1936. And later of the abdication of Edward VIII.
What did the Indians think of the abdication of Edward VIII?
I've got no idea. We were, of course, taken completely by surprise. We had no idea that anything like that was on.
Were your sympathies with the Edward VIII or not?
No, I can't say they were particularly. We were very fond of Edward VIII because... he was our colonel-in-chief as Prince of Wales. And we continued to send him birthday greetings right until his death, although he had ceased to be Well, he'd given up all the honors, everything else that he had had. In fact, he'd even ceased to be our colonel. He couldn't be that and remain as he was.
Were the radio programs which you received from Britain or from India?
From Britain, I expect. I just know. Don't know, honest. No, I don't suppose they were. No, they must have come from India. But I don't really know, because we didn't have a radio in my own house. I didn't have a radio. I could only hear the radio by going to somebody else's house. It wasn't such a common possession in those days as it is today. Yes, there's just one more little thing I'd like to say. That is, I forgot to tell you when I mentioned being at the senior officer school in Belgaum, that Bill Slim, who was later the famous Field Marshal Lord Slim, who won the battles of Burma, he was then the commandant at Belgaum. And when he was giving me my final chat, he said, "I'm not writing a report about you, but I will just say that you're a fluent talker. You're a fluent speaker, and like most fluent speakers, you talk too much. Hence, it's your own fault that I've been talking so much now."